From Fox News Radio, I'm Dana Perino.
Oh, I'm Chris Starwalt.
And this is Perino and Starwalt. I'll tell you what.
Tell you what.
I'm going to tell you something.
Tell me what.
It's hot. It's summer. Okay?
True.
I'm coming to the studio.
Truth.
I will admit I am in shorts and a t-shirt.
It's allowed.
Because I'm working nights.
You don't have, yeah.
I'm working nights.
You're almost on the cat eye.
So I'm trying not to drink Diet Coke as much, right?
Because I gotta,
because it's a long day. You could try a Diet Coke at like 10 and like 4 and then another one at 8.
Battery acid.
So I thought I'd have an iced tea. So I stop at a place downstairs before I got to Fox. I asked for a large iced tea. She said, we only have unsweetened raspberry tea. I said, that's fine. I'll take that. Great. Thank you.
Fine.
She says, that'll be $4.90.
It's a lot of Jack.
And I was like, wait, you know what? Do you ever get that feeling like when you don't know how much something is, but you can kind of guess it's probably like $2, $2.50, whatever,
right.
Maybe $2.75.
Right.
And then you get up there and then they tell you how much it really is and you're too embarrassed to say, I don't want this.
Well, one of the great advantages that the world of getting people to buy things that the retail world has going for it right now is that cash is dying. And I don't know whether you saw the article about Visa basically incentivizing, to use a terrible term, small proprietors to go cashless. One of the good things about cash is that as you spend it and you experience physical interaction with it, you're like, $5 for an iced tea, that seems like more money than I should give you for that. That seems like a $2 thing, not a $5 thing. And places that go cashless, it's painless, right? It's sort of like everybody wants.
You don't even see it.
You don't even see it, and it's like everybody just wants to be your automatic deduction. It's like your subscriptions for the Wall Street Journal. It's like all these other things, and it just blip, 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 blip comes out of your account. You don't even feel it, and that's what they want to take you to. And cash is a good reminder of how much stuff costs.
Well, it just was a lot. I mean, I'm sort of conditioned to New York prices, you know, producer on The Five, Nate Fredman, he said, I try never to get conditioned to that because it's outrageous. And he's right. And he showed me that he stopped at McDonald's and got a $1.90 large Diet Coke, which is the best Diet Coke on the planet, that from McDonald's.
Blech.
So, anyway, I'm just
rot. I'm just like, embalm yourself from the inside.
That's a lot. And also, I usually don't complain about this kind of thing. It was filled to the brim with ice.
Too much ice?
Too much ice.
Was the tea a good quality, though?
It was okay.
It's
sort of the end of the day, so, you know, it's the dregs of the tea, which is never good tea.
I'm right now having a corner bakery black tea, and it's important that we say black tea because an increasing number of frou-frou shishi places are green tea, white tea. What even is white tea? Is that just sand? Like, what are we even selling people anymore? Why do we have to qualify these things? Green iced tea is not a thing. Please stop doing that.
Well, I'm for diversification and marketing, and that they want to find some tea leaves that are white and green and jasmine.
I'm a black supremacist as it relates to iced tea.
Oh,
I don't think we need all of those other things.
And are you sweet or unsweet?
Unsweet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, wait. Now, sweet tea is a treat. I don't want to have the diabetes. I do want to avoid.
It tastes so good, but you cannot do that.
You cannot do that, obviously, all
the
time.
Wean yourself off, peoples, if you're drinking it. Like, even if you get a splash of sweet,
right,
that's better than, like, full sweet.
Well, you have done South Carolina long enough now that you know about a half and half sweet and unsweet.
Yeah, oh, I do know that. I know. I don't do half and half. I do unsweet with a splash. Like, if it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon and it's really hot and I've been at the pool, and I can't drink alcohol during the day because I'll just fall apart and my night will be terrible. So I never drink alcohol during the day.
Okay, stipulated.
Even though I might start.
it would make The Five more interesting.
I drink a lot less now that the show's at 9 o'clock. I mean, not that
go.
I was some big drinker,
no.
But
I'm,
you don't go home and have, you know, like at 6:30, I'd get home and Peter'd say, oh, okay, well, here's dinner. And, you know, like, here's one glass of wine. Yes, of course. And then, you know, you're two in and you're like, do you want one more? I'm like, eh, just a splash. And, you know,
and then
you got to finish the bottle.
And then Peter knows that the correct answer is that if he can make the splash the size of an ocean going tanker.
He and I have a ongoing tussle, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
He is a very light pour.
Okay.
Okay. And he says no.
And you're a cowgirl.
He says the glasses are large, but they're really not. I mean, imagine the wine glasses at my house. They're not that big. Okay.
Right.
It's not like a goblet.
Right, because it's you. Right, exactly.
And he always says that I'm a heavy pour. I am generous.
That's very British. That's very British. That is the most British discussion ever. I like that. Quite so.
So I guess we should talk about Washington.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to talk about that's not Washington?
I want to congratulate.
Oh, can I tell you, I never did open up that dried meat fruit packet.
You never
it's
did?
It's still sitting on the counter.
Why
The craisins.
Yeah.
I can't do it. I'm like, this is gross.
I feel you.
But I might take it. I have a little trip coming up. I might take it on the plane tomorrow and let my husband eat it.
I found a guy on Amazon that takes whole packs of Quest bars, which are the least odious. And they're doing a lot of good, interesting stuff. And then there's another one, I can't remember the name of it. It's got a crunchy texture to it that is really the best protein bar, and I can't remember the name of it right now, and I'm so sorry because it's quite good. And they have a salted caramel one that's dynamite. But Quest, which is the, like, okay, I can't have food, but I could have this, and this is okay. And there is that slight Bayer pesticide unit flavor that happens at the end. I'm not going to lie to you, but the Quest bar is the best of the bunch. And there's a guy that takes whole boxes of Quest bars, breaks them down, and repackages them into sampler flavors. And this guy is now my friend on Amazon, and I've hit him up twice. I'm pretty excited about it.
Now that is fascinating.
Quite so.
Not really.
Quite so.
No, not really. It's hot down in Washington.
It is hot down in Washington. It is hot down in Washington as the president gets ready.
Is he leaving right now? Right, he's going to go
to go to Paris. To have dinner with Emmanuel.
I might want to get out of town, too.
I would definitely want to get out of town. And he's going to go have dinner with Emmanuel Macron, the Justin Trudeau.
That's a lot. I have to say, I think it was a great invitation.
Yeah.
I think it's awesome that the president accepted.
Yes.
And it was that's a lot of travel for somebody. I know it's Air Force One and it's super comfortable, but it's still a lot of wear and tear on the body when you're trying to get all sorts of other things done at the White House. That he accepted the invitation, I thought, was really good for diplomacy.
And I thought it was good that Macron...
Please stop? It's Macron.
Macron?
Whatever.
if he was from Enid, Oklahoma, he'd be Macron. But I think we have to say Macron. It was good of him. The question is, should the world shun Trump because he rejected the Paris climate thing? Should the world shun Trump because of this?
I don't think so.
And
I think they're over it.
I think not only are they over it, it's like, okay, this is not an impossible guy to figure out. I think that for Merkel... For Macron, for Trudeau, for all of these guys, this is not an impossible guy to figure out. Trump wants to be praised. He wants to be told that he is wonderful, wonderful, and he wants to be at the head of the class. And he represents the United States. So I think
he also likes the one-on-one meetings. And Macron might try to talk to him about this big ice shelf thing that just fell off in the Atlantic that apparently is the size of Delaware.
Size of Connecticut, the size of Delaware. I've heard it, but it's big.
But Delaware's not that big.
Delaware's fairly small. As states go. It's no West Virginia. It's definitely no Wyoming.
Definitely not.
But
yeah, he might try to say, you know, maybe we could try to work on something. And I think the president could be open to that.
I think the president is very susceptible to flattery. I think that if Macron tells him, you and I, and we can make this work, and look,
and if he says it'll be, like, Macron would be smart to say, this would be good for American workers, and
let me show you how it will work for America.
I'm not buying it, but.
Well, but he's going to take him to dinner at the restaurant, the new restaurant they have at the Eiffel Tower on the second level, and their specialty is blue lobster. and the president, of course, likes his steaks like you do, which is terrible. And Macron, though, is going to show off and give Trump this very royal treatment. And then, by the way, how cool... Trump is there for the celebration, of course, of Bastille Day, which, by the way, your revolution was terrible, France. Don't do that again.
Les Mis. Great book.
Great musical, terrible revolution. And but he's also there to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the U.S. entry into World War I, the moment when the United States. Now, I have my own reservations about whether or not that was the right choice and about Woodrow Wilson and propaganda and all of that stuff. But certainly it was the moment that the United States really became a world power. And though it is debated about whether or not it was John Blackjack Pershing who went up to the Marquis de Lafayette's tomb and said, Lafayette, we are here. he would later say that it was his aide, Stanton, Colonel Stanton, who said it in a speech where he was authorized to speak for him. But reporters contemporaneously said that it was, in fact, Pershing who said that about Lafayette. But the point that we have arrived, the United States is here to pay back our debt. You know, the United States owes a double debt to the great powers of Europe. One, certainly to the French, without whom our revolution really wouldn't have been possible. If it hadn't been for France's willingness to harass Britain and provide naval power to us, we wouldn't have, our revolution wouldn't have succeeded. But number two, for the ideas. France was not able to put the ideas of the Enlightenment into practice for a long time because of a lot of issues. And we can have a debate sometime about Burkean conservatism versus Jacobin, blah, blah, blah.
That's not.
We won't. I promise. You gave me that on our Independence Day special.
My, wow.
I promise we won't. But we took the ideas of Rousseau, and we certainly of the Scottish Enlightenment and the British Enlightenment put them into practice. France never could, and that's a cool anniversary. 100 years of us coming to repay that debt.
Yep. So when the president comes home, the issues, you know, like every Monday, there's a new story that furthers the Russia story.
Right.
This week has been a big one. And it's Wednesday afternoon, and apparently, according to Jonathan Swan of Axios, the White House believes that they are under no illusion that they have a big PR problem. They don't necessarily think they have a legal problem, but they are aware of what they're up against. Does that jive with what you?
What does that mean?
Hearing?
What is, I don't know. What is he trying to say? They know that they have a big PR problem.
That's what he said. He reported that they know that they have a big PR problem, but they do not believe they have a legal problem in regards to this latest revelation about Don Trump Jr. meeting with the Russian lawyer who, whether on false pretenses or whatever pretenses she wanted to meet.
Well, the pretense is he understood
as
the
he
meeting.
Understood, that's true.
The pretenses under which he understood the meeting to be taking place were grody. I am weary of the, it's not illegal, it's just gross. Okay, why? It's the Clinton people did this throughout the 2016 election. No smoking gun, and it's not a crime. And I heard it over and over, and the Clinton Foundation did this gross thing, and that was disgusting, and this is horrible, but there's no crime and there's no smoking gun. And now it's the Republicans who say all the time, it's no crime and it's no smoking gun. And I think we have defined deviancy down so far in our culture. We have gotten to the point now where something not, you not being able to prosecute a person for a crime makes it okay. That's weak. It's okay. I thought that for part of his interview with Sean Hannity, that the president's son offered some contrite words, right? He said that he would have done it differently, and he said that the learning curve is steep and that he didn't know what he was doing. And those are contrite words. Those are the things that you say, yeah, I wish I wouldn't have done this. He was overeager to talk to somebody that he thought was from the Kremlin or representing the Russian government who was promising to deliver dirt on Hillary Clinton. The rapidity with which defenders of the administration have run first to it's not illegal and then run past that into almost this point about he was smart to do it. Smart to do. It's not smart.
I don't buy the smart thing.
It's not smart to do. And who cares if everybody does it? Try to do a little better.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, especially because if you're coming in as you're the outsider and you're going to do things differently in Washington.
Drain the swamp.
But
right,
actually,
exactly.
I don't know. I thought Tucker Carlson made a good point last night. I guess I'm thinking this is a good point, but I don't know how relatable this is. But he said all across Washington, D.C., at any given hour, you have foreign ambassadors trying to influence policy in the United States.
Okay.
And there's dinners and there's parties and there's, there are a lot of American companies, American lobbyists trying to, well, basically getting money from foreign governments to try to influence American policy. Like that is true.
Sure.
But yet still that's not exactly relatable to this. I do want to ask you one thing though, because I think this is the most interesting, which is previous leaks about the White House had been sort of coming from somewhere that his supporters would call the deep state.
Right.
This is not the deep state. So,
unless the deep state is Jared Kushner.
Well, and I guess that is an assumption. So, so Axios also just wrote a piece that says there is some movement at the White House, or some thinking amongst the lawyers, that they want to put some sort of a wall between President Trump and Kushner on this issue.
Yeah.
Well, but he's the most important advisor. So how do you do that?
Well, is he the most important advisor anymore? I don't know. Based on who's leaking, the constant leak from this administration, from senior advisors of the president. Sometimes Bannon's going to get fired. Sometimes Priebus is going to get fired. Sometimes Kushner's in, Bannon's out. Everybody's leaking. The profligacy of the leaking is further reflected in the fact that the New York Times basically gave away how they got the story on these emails from the president's son, which is Kushner told him, or told somebody, that it was his lawyer's discovery of this, that they said, we got to disclose this, and that Paul Manafort, former campaign chairman, also disclosed it to Congress. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out. By the way, why is it always rocket science? Anyway, it doesn't take a neuroscientist to figure out that by dangling this in front of Democrats and saying, hey, this meeting is out there, that's where the New York Times got this get. And in fact, when you have Kushner divulging information, the president in an interview with Reuters said that he only heard about it. Basically, it's the same thing Obama used to say. I heard about it on the news.
Yep.
And
does nobody tell you anything, sir?
Right. Somebody ought to let you know. Because it is
hard to imagine that nobody told the president that this story was coming.
And that his son was about to be at the center of this maelstrom of negative coverage, and that his son was going to have to admit to being skeevy. And by the way, and we should just point out as an aside, the takeaway from this revelation, it's not about whether it's illegal. It's not about blah, 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 blah. It is the death of a talking point. The story is about the death of a talking point, and that Mike Pence used, that the president used, that everybody used. No shred, zero evidence, any collusion, anything, witch hunt, blah, 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 blah. And then you have this paper trail of the president's son saying, I want to work with the Kremlin to hurt Hillary Clinton. So it's the death of a very important talking point for Republicans. And that's pretty much what it is at this point.
Well, but if I could interject then, because could I sprinkle in a couple of mailbag questions that have to do with this?
Oh, yeah.
For you? Okay. So
it is mailbag. Yay.
It is, yes. Matt from Pennsylvania, do you think this Don Jr. email chain will hurt Trump's base? I think he means, will it erode support from Trump's base?
Is this the thing that, I mean, ask yourself a question. The simplest way to do this is just to ask yourself a question. If it was revealed tomorrow that the president knew that the worst that they had said was true, that the president knew, number one, but that number two, his campaign had actively provided information to Kremlin affiliates in an effort to harm Hillary Clinton. Go ahead and just jump all the way out to the worst case scenario, the worst thing, active, avid, enthusiastic collusion between intimates of the president, people on his campaign, and the Russians. How do you feel? Are you ready to abandon the president? Are you ready to, do you lament your vote? Do you wish that Hillary Clinton had become president? I think for, I don't know, a quarter of the country, they'll live with it. I mean, on the day that the story broke about Bill Clinton's assignations, which I think everybody now would deem...
It's such a kind way to say it.
Well, it's a family podcast. But Bill Clinton's assignations with a 21-year-old White House intern. On the day after, when the world was on fire, Hillary Clinton had already a scheduled interview on the Today Show with Matt Lauer. And so they went ahead with the interview because they were going to deploy her as part of the effort to staunch this, because it's just not true. And she sat with him and she said, well, obviously, Matt, if the things that they were saying were true, the president would have to resign. Obviously, but none of that's true. He didn't do anything like that.
Right, I remember that.
He didn't do anything like that. That's ridiculous. This is vast right-wing conspiracy. Now, what's funny is, at that moment, Kenneth Starr, knew that she was not, that what she said was not the truth. Now, in the Clintons' version of it, she was deceived also, and she was telling what she believed to be the truth, and then in time, revelations would come forward, including a DNA sample on a Blue Gap dress. Ken Starr had the dress. They knew, and they waited because they thought that, well, certainly the president's not going to drag the country through the indignity of a prosecution over such assignations. Certainly he's not going to do that. He knows the writing's on the wall. What happened for Democrats was what would have been unthinkable at the beginning, that if you would have said to them, the president did it and carried on this long relationship with this White House intern and called her with salacious phone calls and the thing about the cigar and in the Oval Office and all of those things. He did all of that. He lied about it, and he sought to cover it up. If you would have said all of that to Democrats on the first day, they would have said, well, we can't stand with him. It's too much. But what the Clintons very successfully did was drip, 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 drip. It came out over time. So that by the end, the Democrats said, you know, or what? And they stood with him. And they stood by. And when the Kathleen Willey stuff came out, and when all the other stuff came out, the Democrats said, what are you going to do?
Okay, so then another person wants to know, why is it that only things that Republicans do seem to be wrong? Democrats do same things. I think he's referring to the Ukrainian stuff. And all is okay. I can only believe it's because of media twists. And I understand that if you're following this closely, you're a Trump supporter, you're looking at the Ukrainian support for Hillary Clinton to try to bring down, I guess, Manafort. The thing, well, why isn't that in the news? And well, I can only imagine it's because it's just not, they didn't win.
Yeah, if Hillary, she lost the election. She is bad. She is decisively bad at running for president. And I guess this is part of the everybody does it. Everybody colludes with, and the Clintons, by the way, in the full spirit of whataboutism, everybody's favorite word of the day. What about Charlie Tree? What about the Clinton and the Gore and illegal campaign contributions and picking up money at Buddhist temples and no controlling legal authority, which was Albert R. Gore Jr.'s favorite phrase, the beloved phrase. No controlling legal authority. Translation, it's probably against the law. What we did and how that money got funneled from the People's Republic of China into Democratic campaign coffers, well, there just isn't a controlling legal authority. It's illegal, but there's no one available to prosecute for it. So, poof. Winning, the consequences of winning
is that you become the public person.
That you become the public person and you become the target.
Yeah.
Lots of people in the past have done skeevy things with foreign nationals, but the one that matters is the one that wins.
Can I ask you, since I'm looking up and I see Brett Baer is reporting, I wanted to ask you just briefly, because I'd rather get to the mailbag, the Republicans are going to introduce a new health care bill.
Yep.
It's not going to be that different than the last time around, but tweaks around the edges, got some opiate money in there. Maybe Cruz Amendment is going to get added.
And apparently the parliamentarian is going to say that the parliamentarian has allowed that Cruz's changes to the regulations surrounding the provision of health care can go through. And so
that surprised me. That's a big win for them, for Cruz.
Well, it's a big win for Cruz.
Yeah.
It's a big loss for moderate Republicans who don't want to have to vote for that. And we're hoping that the parliamentarian would spare them.
I'll talk to my friend, Keith Hennessy. He's out at Stanford now at Hoover. He is
brilliant mammal.
So I asked him, I said, are you for this or against this? Because he's a good barometer for me.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm for being able to buy whatever insurance I want to buy.
Sure.
I'm for it. I was like, wow, I got to take another look at this thing.
So the question, I don't know anything about policy. The question for me is, are there 51 votes for it? That's the operant question is. And by the way, they have to also have a vote to get to the rule. They have they have to put the blasting cap on the dynamite before they can blow the face in the mine. And that's an open question about whether they can even get to the matter. Mitch McConnell makes a very credible threat to his members, which is, fine, you don't want this. I don't want this. Nobody wants this. But if you don't do this, we're going to have to come back here and we're going to have to patch Obamacare, and it's going to be a $8 billion payout to the insurance industry. Some Republican votes will be necessary on it, and there'll be nothing you like in it at all. It will be because they'll need those 8 Democratic votes. There'll be nothing that Republicans like in it at all, and it'll be more than 8 Democratic votes because a half a dozen at least conservative Republicans will abandon it from Jump Street. And McConnell is playing very hard ball with these guys. Okay, we're going to stay. You want to stay and you want to work on it? That's fine. But don't kid yourself and don't think that at the end, because the Republicans know now, they've accepted the painful arithmetic, they're going to have to patch Obamacare at the end.
Not only that, but I heard today that they're not going to be able to pass a budget. And so they're going to have to go to an omnibus, which means that the Republicans will have to work with the Democrats. And you can just imagine how that's going to go down.
Well, if they cannot pass a budget.
Yep, I know.
If they cannot pass a budget.
I know.
In control of the House and of the Senate.
And the White House.
And the White House. If they cannot pass a budget. So they got until the end of September to pass a budget. And on all the laws and all the profits depend upon this budget. Right? This is the thing. It averts the government shutdown. It's the vehicle for budget reconciliation. It is a vehicle for taxes. It could be a vehicle for healthcare. If they stumble and stagger on this, and yeah, they can side door on reconciliation, changes to the healthcare law, but honestly, at what point do you say you guys were not ready for prime time and you just can't handle the freight?
Well, our new colleague, former Congressman Jason Chaffetz, would say that's accurate.
Well, yeah.
Based on some of his appearances, welcome new addition to Fox News Channel, of course. Let me move on to something else.
Yes.
Laura Westcott wants me to ask you about your summer vacations. What historical locations do you most want to show your boys that he hasn't shown them yet?
That I have not shown them yet?
Mm-hmm.
I am very keen... I want to go to, why am I drawing a blank on the name of it right now? The final battle of the Revolutionary War. Yorktown. I'm very keen to go to Yorktown, which is a great place to go. I think that's very cool. I also like in St. Louis, the humble place at the courthouse where the Dred Scott decision was read out.
Mm.
And I think that's pretty cool.
That's neat.
I think that...
Rushmore.
You like Rushmore, but nothing happened at Rushmore. I mean, it's cool that they did it. I mean, it's pretty, but nothing happened there.
Well, they can go to the battle of... what's that battle?
The big one?
That big one.
The Little Bighorn?
Yes.
They can definitely do that. Did you ever read the Custer book... Son of the Morning Star?
No.
Good read. What else would what's out west? What should people go see out west?
Well, I guess when you think of history and like locations that you want to see, I mean, I think it gets a little harder.
I love Carson City.
Oh, okay. Out in Nevada?
Yeah, and the Mother Lode and the Silver Strike and the Wild West,
yeah.
and the Civil
Donner
War.
Donner Pass.
Woof. Speaking of the Republicans in Congress.
All right, Robert Jacob, or the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Robert Jacob Marone wants to know, what's the best way to pan fry a steak, or should the only way be on a grill?
There's a lot of ways to cook a steak. To pan fry a steak... So you can, and by the way, there's nothing wrong with minute steak. There's nothing wrong with a very thin steak that you flash fry in a white hot cast iron skillet. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, for a real steak, for a daddy rat steak, you are going to want to get that cast iron skillet very hot. Now, there's a salt method, which I do endorse, about placing salt all over the bottom of the pan, prevents burning, blah, 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 blah. But there is some risk involved. What I would say is have the doors open because you're going to set off the smoke detector for sure. But get that pan enormously hot and put that sucker down and sear it off till it gets to a color, that bronzed color that you really like. And then put it in a 450-degree oven. Have the oven ready. You might want to use an oven mitt, but have the oven ready and put it in there and let it finish cooking in the oven. Don't try to finish a thick steak because a real steak is an inch and a half thick. Could be 2 inches, but is an inch and a half thick, at least more than an inch. And put it in the oven and let it finish cooking in a very hot oven. It's only going to take 5 to 10 minutes more in the oven. And then take it out and let it rest for 15 minutes and let it cool down. Let all that craziness stop. And you're going to have a nice medium rare steak.
Okay. And Ray Jenkins wants to know, what's in the old meat bag today?
I've eaten not enough today. What did I have? I've not eaten enough today. I had a protein bar. I feel like I ate lunch, though. I feel like lunch must have taken place, or otherwise I would have probably attacked a person with my bare hands.
Well, then G-Money Swag wants to have an update on Shiv and the workout routine.
Yeah, Shiv and I broke up. It's cool. No, it's fine.
Did you drop him or did he drop you?
He wanted a commitment that I wasn't prepared for. And
like 3 times a week?
No, like for like 6 months or something.
He wanted
to lock me in. So I still go, and he taught me a lot, and I'm really grateful to him.
That's nice.
It very good. I probably don't exercise to the point that I want to puke in the way that I did when Shiv would break me down. So I'm sure that in time I will come to regret the Shiv breakup of 2017. But I wasn't prepared to go deep.
So I'm going to ask you this. You might not really be prepared to answer this question. I don't know. But there were several questions regarding this topic, and I'll just use Jack Whiteman's.
I hope it's about ribs.
He says, can you please, well, okay, he has two questions.
Okay.
His first question is, if you could ask him the best way to prepare ribs, I'd be eternally grateful.
Okay, I like that.
Did you know that about, did you read this question before?
No, but I do like ribs a lot.
Okay, so what's your answer?
Well, beef ribs are great, by the way. On the grill, very quick. I do a mustard glaze on those, but just crackle them off and just on a grill. And that's on a hot grill. You don't barbecue them. You just grill them for the beef ribs. For pork ribs, I don't think there's anything. Obviously, the best way to do it is in a controlled, low-smoke environment. You're a big green egg fan. That's fine. You can do it on a Weber kettle grill. You can do it a lot of different ways, but the whole thing is, again, that 225 heat, that low smoke. I like hickory, holding the temperature down. I like, and this is me, again, if I do them at home, I'm going to do them in the oven. This is the cheat. I'm sorry. I hate to say it. But if I do it at home, I'm going to do the cheat. I'm going to wrap them in foil. If I'm doing baby back ribs, I'm going to wrap them in foil. I'm going to vent the bottom 3 or 4 places so that it and by the way, score the fat underneath so that it crackles. I'm going to rub them the day before, put them in the fridge, and then I'm going to put them in individual foil things, and I'm going to cook them in the oven in a 225-degree oven to get them ready. And then I'm going to smoke them because that way I can do just about 3 hours of a good smoke on a grill and I'm ready to go. I know that's not purity. I know that that's lackadaisical, but it tastes delicious.
By the way, my sister made a brisket on Saturday for my mom's 70th birthday for her party.
Did she do the boiled meat?
No,
method?
She said she did and that it turned out delicious and that everybody was raving about it.
We've already established that if you then mix everything with barbecue sauce and put it in a crock pot, that a pair of tree-torn tennis shoes could be pretty good.
Anyway, this is the substantive question he wanted to ask.
Hit me.
Can you please ask him about the net neutrality debate?
Oh, Lord.
And your personal opinion on what is right and what will happen. And I was interested that so many people had sent questions in about this. We had over 150 questions for you today. And I just saw it several times, and, you know, I pay attention to that issue sort of on the periphery. I read the Wall Street Journal editorial page every day,
right.
So, like, they cover it, and
it
Holman
matters.
Jenkins has been really good on the coverage of it.
It matters.
And I guess that Ajit Pai, the
FCC chairman,
is on the road, you know, out talking about this, which is maybe why people are interested. And I think for rural America is very concerned based on these questions.
And then the question is, what is the internet? So the previous concept of the internet, the way that we understood the internet, was that there are homepages, and you have a homepage, and I have a homepage, and then I post things on my homepage. Or is the internet the pipes? Is the internet the internet itself? Is the internet the information that is out there that we provide, that in a tweet, in a video posted at foxnews.com, is that the internet? Is the information the internet, the data, or is it the physical pipes themselves? And the answer is it's both things, right? It's both of those things. The people who build a network of fiber, and it's expensive, right? This is the same. This is not different than the argument about who owns the telephone, right? When they broke up AT&T and the Bell system, the argument was, they said, we built it. Why should we have to share it with other people?
Right.
And the government said, well, because everybody needs the telephone to call the police, and they need the telephone to call their Aunt Mabel, and they need the telephone. And to do business and to be an American, the telephone's just a necessity. The truth for us is that that system of pipes, of fiber optic, of fiber that's out there and spreading, because, by the way, as you say, with rural America, to whom and for whom does the internet matter most than rural Americans, right?
Yeah.
People in Alaska, people in Montana, people in far-flung corners of the world, their lives have been radically altered, and they can get to things and do things that they couldn't do before. I think that net neutrality, as designed by the previous administration's FCC, is an insufficient answer to a larger question. And the larger question is, who owns this space? Whose is this? And is it, in fact, a public utility in the same way that the telephone is? Is it a public utility in the same way that even water is, or that electricity is? Because we do create special status for things that are that important. And regulators, the pro-regulatory people, say, this is that important, so we have to regulate it. But even if you thought that was true, the regime envisioned by Tom Wheeler's FCC, I think, is probably not adequate to the moment.
All right, two more questions.
Okay.
Johnny Johnerson, great name.
Great.
Wants to know, what were you like as a kid? And we don't have that much time.
Smaller.
Of course, all of us were smaller.
No, I was a big dork. I told you the story about how I used to wear a jacket and tie to
school.
Yeah,
and the briefcase.
I was a pretty smooth operator.
Did your teachers love that? Did they laugh about it?
I think some of them did. I think some of them found me annoying. Mm. I'm sure a lot of people found me annoying. I think what I was as a kid was I was very curious about a lot of stuff. I was very engaged in a lot of stuff. But I craved always very much for my a pastor of mine said something really great, and I have used it many times in my life. I know we don't have much time, but I've used it many times in my life, and it's because it's so true. What do we all want? To be truly known and truly loved.
Yeah.
And I crave the acceptance of my peers, but I knew that I was weirder than them. And I would just say to every kid, I would say to every small person, to every parent of every small person, remind your kids that everybody feels that way.
Everybody does.
Everybody feels that way.
That's great. Polly Barrett Irwin, who is a really great
listener. Hi, Polly.
She wants to know, what is the etymology of the phrase dropping dime?
Dropping the dime on somebody?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I should have looked that up. But
I don't know either.
It's an old gangland term about somebody who snitches. They drop the dime on somebody, and now everybody will tell us on Twitter.
Maybe that was when you called somebody, right? Was a phone call only 10 cents?
Let's go with that. That they dropped the dime in the phone and called and snitched. But it's snitching.
Then it was increased to 20 cents.
Then it was 25
dropping
cents.
Dropping two dimes.
I had so much to tell. Jared Kushner had so much to tell, he dropped two dimes.
Two dimes, right. Okay, and a last question for you from Daryl Lanier, I believe.
Hi, Daryl.
What are your favorite ingredients on a nothing burger? That was cute.
That is cute. I'll give him the win on that one.
Oh, my goodness. Okay,
do
trivia.
Do you have trivia, even though Bonewald's off?
Yeah, I've got two questions from him.
Oh, Bonewald, that's how much Bonewald loves to defeat me, is that even when he's on vacation, he drops the dime on me. Okay,
I'm ready. In the 1976 Iowa caucus, Jimmy Carter received the most votes of any candidate, 28%, but fell short to uncommitted, 37%. Mm-hmm. Aside from that instance, there have been only two non-incumbents to win the Iowa caucus and later win the presidency. Name
them. Okay. Two non-incumbents to win the Iowa caucus and also win the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
George W. Bush mm-hmm. is one. And who is the other? Barack Obama?
Yes.
Yep. Okay. There you
all
go.
Right, all right. All right. All right. All right.
All right. All right.
Okay.
All right.
Question two. Since 1950, only three non-incumbents have won the New Hampshire primary multiple times. Can you name two of them?
Multiple New Hampshire winners, non-incumbents.
Yep.
John H. McCain.
Uh-huh.
Non-incumbent, multiple New Hampshire winner since 1950.
Getting difficult to come up with questions.
So, and there are three?
There are three.
Okay, so.
Got one.
Right. Or no, is he John S. McCain? He's John Sidney McCain. That's one. Willard M. Romney?
Nope.
No? Didn't he win? I thought he won. He ran. Felt like he ran a lot. Non-incumbent. And this person didn't have to go on to win the presidency, right? That's not a condition
Correct.
On this one.
Correct.
Did Pat Buchanan win twice? Mm-mm. No. She's waving me
Richard
off.
Nixon.
Oh, Richard M. Nixon. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. That's
and then
a good one.
Senator Estes.
Kefauver.
Kefauver.
Yes, Kefauver could always win in New Hampshire. Okay, Jason. Happy vacation.
Happy vacation, Bonewald.
You defeated me with Estes Kefauver.
Very fun. Very fun. All right. Well, this has been great. Thank you. All right.
Enjoy your iced tea.
You cannot enjoy an iced tea that costs $5. You can't.
Mm-hmm.
You can enjoy a Kit Kat that costs $5 if you have been traveling all day and that's
and
the only thing
on
in the mini bar.
Yeah, that's
exactly.
right.
Exactly. All right, let that be a lesson to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, for more podcasts, go to foxnewspodcast.com and don't forget to subscribe to this one on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a review. This has been Perino and Starwalt. I'll tell you what on Fox News Radio.